Were you able to come up with at least five animals? If you're unaware of it, there are at least 125 different animals mentioned in the Bible. That's a bunch. Along with mentioning those 100-plus animals in Scripture, God has given some facts about animals. And sometimes with those animals and the facts, you also find that there are certain rules, especially in the Old Testament. One Old Testament rule is found in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 22. If you were to go back there, especially perhaps in this culture and this area, it might be especially significant for us as far as a rule that stands out concerning animals. God said when it was time to plow, you don't take a donkey and you don't take an ox and put them together to plow. God said just don't do it. Now someone says, well, why would God prevent the yoking of those two animals when it came time to plow? There is no reason given for that in Deuteronomy chapter 22. There is, though, I think, a hint as to why God gave that rule. You see, under the Old Testament, ox were clean animals. And you have, with the oxen, you have donkeys, and they were unclean animals. It seems to me, and this is, I think, a pretty good consensus among the scholars who have commented on that passage, that God was trying to tell his people there's some things that don't mix. Just as we would not mix certain things in our society, God says, I'm trying to indicate to you through the joining of the unclean and the clean and the unclean animal, don't do that, that there are some things that you need to avoid. When it comes to our life, we don't want to join together God and the world or God and sin. To each one who's chosen to come out this morning, as Scott already indicated, thank you very much for being present. I'm also grateful for the invitation to be one of the speakers, and to each one who helped in some way to make this day possible, thank you. We know if you've had any involvement with this kind of program that it takes some time, some effort, certainly some money. And for everything that was done, again, thank you. Certainly want to thank Scott and the elders for allowing me to be a participant. As Scott mentioned, the topic for this hour is, my children are gone, and now what do I do? When I talked with Scott about this, I said, well, ideally the answer is do what we've been doing. Ideally, as our kids were being raised in the home, we were faithful servants of God, and now that the kids are headed in their own direction, maybe they've gotten married, maybe they're headed off to college, maybe they're going into the workforce, ideally, we were fully committed to God, and now we're going to stay fully committed to God. But what's right is not always how things are. People, perhaps they had the right priorities for a number of years as the kids were being grown, but you know, as the kids leave, parents can begin to rethink things. The kids are gone. We now have more time. Maybe we have more money, more resources, more free time at work. And now we're going to shift our priorities. In the Bible, there are two events which are familiar to most people. One of those events is the giving of the Ten Commandments. The other event which is familiar to many is the Sermon on the Mount. And if you take the Sermon on the Mount and you compare that with the Ten Commandments, you begin to find a number of significant and noteworthy parallels. For example, in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3, we have there the beginning of the commandments. God said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. God said to his people in Exodus chapter 20, you and I are in a covenant. We are in this special relationship. And God said at the beginning of that covenant, you need to know. You need to realize that I am the one who needs to be first in your life. The first commandment was, I need to be first. I must be first in your home. God said to his people, I must be a higher priority than your father, mother, brother, sister, your friends. I must have a higher priority than your work and your recreation, your hobbies. Your lives, God said, need to center around me. God gave that commandment, and he did not forget about it in the later years. As you think through Hebrew history, what do you find a little later? Well, you find that Israel had become a nation, that it was ruled over by three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, all ruled over the United Kingdom. Do you remember how from 2 Chronicles chapter 1, Solomon was given an option by God to ask for whatever he wanted? In essence, when God made that offer to Solomon, God was saying this, King Solomon, which God do you want to follow? Solomon, you tell me what God you want in your life. Solomon, do you want gold? Do you want money? Do you want wealth? If Solomon had said, God, the one thing I want is money, he would have been saying to God, I want money. I want God. I want my God to be well. Well, then there's another thing in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, and that is his enemies. Solomon could have said, God, I want you to crush my enemies. That would have been a way of saying, God, the deity that I want is the God of power. And then there was another option in 2 Chronicles chapter 1. Solomon could have asked for beautiful women. Had the prettiest women that have ever graced the planet Earth. And had Solomon made that choice, he would have been saying, the God that I want is the God of pleasure. Solomon, you tell me what you want. You tell me which God you want to follow. You remember what Solomon said? This is a great people. And God, I need to have wisdom to rule in righteousness. Solomon chose the right God. That's what he did. And likely we remember that fact. But you know what happened to that great king? The God of wealth got a hold of him, didn't it? And moving forward a little bit in biblical history, the God of power also got its hooks into him, didn't he? And is it also not true with all those women that Solomon brought? The God of pleasure also found a path into his heart. You see, Solomon finally rejected that one God. He began serving the very gods he initially said no to. When you begin to look at the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says in that book that he rejected the very he accepted the very gods he'd initially rejected. The book of Ecclesiastes affirms that the serving of other gods was Solomon's grand pursuit. You see, Solomon, figuratively speaking, going back to Deuteronomy 22, what did he try to do? He tried to plow with the ox and the donkey. God said way back when, you don't do that. That's not going to work. Solomon tried that, and he failed. When we come to the Sermon on the Mount, that second passage, which is so well known, what do we find? Do we not find Jesus there discussing the very first of the Ten Commandments? The sixth chapter of Matthew, calling your attention specifically to Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24, it's there that Jesus talked about serving two masters. Those in the first century were familiar with slavery. They knew what it was like. Now, we may not be too familiar with slavery, but we know what the Lord meant. Imagine a soldier trying to serve in two opposing armies. Imagine having two contradictory sets of directions and trying to follow them at the same time. Jesus said we can't do both. We can't have two number one priorities. After the Lord made that point, he then says this in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24. The Lord said you're going to love one and you're going to hate the other. You can't serve both. Someone once wrote, we can cheer for two teams. I can work for two employers. I can volunteer for two charities, but I can serve only one master. I can have two friends. I can maintain two interests. I can own both a foreign and domestic car, but I can serve only one master. I can support two candidates. I can attend two rival colleges. I can compete in differing competing companies, but I can serve only one master. When you look at the Ten Commandments, the first one, or you look at Jesus' sermon in Matthew chapter 6, or you look at Deuteronomy chapter 22, we find the same message. Seek God fully, focus on him, put him first in your life, don't let anything compete with him. And then going back to Matthew chapter 6, verse 24 ends with, you can't serve God and mammon. That is impossible. There's an old saying about having one foot in the church and one foot in the world. People have been trying that for a long, long time, and it doesn't work. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, well, where on earth is he going? You know, I heard that topic, and I just don't see any connection. Well, let's connect some dots. If the people who raise children have not fouled up their priorities in those child-rearing years, after the kids leave home, parents may then begin to reprioritize things in an improper manner. You see, parents can begin to think, well, we sacrificed for a long time. Have one child for 18 years. Two kids, maybe 20. Or maybe 30 plus years. We gave, we sacrificed, we helped, and now it's my turn. I can call the name of a family who, after the age of about 45 or 48, said to me, we have lived for God, we had him as our first priority in life, and now it is about us. God got his time, and now it's our time. Now, people may not say that, but a lot of times that's how they live. It's not uncommon for the empty nesters to say, what are we going to do now? As I alluded to earlier, a lot of times people see this as a period where they have greater freedom. For some, they say, especially in our area, let's buy an RV. Always wanted to travel. And now without kids, we've got some extra money, some extra time. Let's get an RV and let's travel. Others have decided, let's build a dream home. We've always wanted a particular house, and now we weren't not going to have kids. Maybe factor in some space for the grandkids, but let's build a house. Someone else says, let's plan for our retirement. We're not getting any younger, and let's make sure that we can continue to build a good nest egg. Thoughts, money, effort, fun, relaxation, all starts heading towards self. That's the world's example of what to do when the kids are raised. And sometimes, far too often, perhaps, Christians fall into that same category. My answer to what we need to do when kids leave home is this. Unleash the power of God in your life. What I have to say from this point forward may be some of the most important information you ever hear. Letting this information trying to settle in might take a little while. So I've prepared a handout. It's in the foyer if you want to pick it up at some time that's convenient for you today. But if you will believe, and if you will follow the information that's going to be dealt with in the remainder of this lesson, and if you will study it further as far as the handout that's in the foyer, your life will never be the same. Never be the same. In just a moment, I'm going to introduce a verse from Psalm 78. Now, that passage may not sound all that familiar to you. There are 72 verses in Psalm 78. And as you look at that psalm, you find that by and large, it is a psalm which is historical. In fact, it's really about Hebrew history. Many significant events from Hebrew history are listed. About halfway through this psalm, though, you have Psalm 78 and verse 41. And this verse, if you have not ever looked at it or thought about it or read it in the King James or New King James, it needs to be burned into your mind. I normally use the American Standard Translation from 1901, and the ASV says this: "And they turned again and tempted God and provoked the Holy One of Israel." Now, if I were reading that in my own and I checked no other translation, I probably wouldn't think very much about that passage. But if you were to look at the King James, or you were to look at the New King James, you would find a word that does grab the attention. The King James, the New King James, and maybe some others, but especially these two, they use the word limited. God said the Hebrew people limited his power. Now let that sink in. God says to his people, you limited my power. You restricted my power. You choked off my power. You reduced my power. God says you cut off my power from your life. Now that translation is supported by the context. You can read all 72 verses and you can see, yes, that translation makes a great deal of sense. Like the Hebrews, we can in our lives limit. We can choke off. We can restrict God's power in our lives. Now, how did the Hebrews limit, restrict, cut off, choke off God's power in their lives? Psalm 78 tells us. Those people had the wrong priorities. When our children leave home, we can, if we've not up to that point, we can begin to restrict God's power in our lives by making bad choices. In this case, wrong priorities. Like Solomon, we can begin to let those false gods creep in. The desire for power, the desire for wealth, pleasure, whatever it might be. Along with Psalm 78, there is another key essential passage, and this one is better known. This also comes from the Old Testament. It comes from a place that may not be read or studied or taught too often. It's in the book of 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 16. I'm not going to take the time to go back and look at all the historical information surrounding the passage. You can do that on your own if you so wish. But the key verse is 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9. That verse says, "For the eyes of Jehovah," that's the subject under consideration. And then we have some information about the eyes of Jehovah. What do God's eyes, figuratively speaking, do? The Bible says they run. God's eyes run. Well, where do they run, God? God says, "My eyes run to and fro the earth." God says, "I'm looking every single day continuously. I'm checking the earth out." God, why would you do that? 2 Chronicles 16, 9 tells us. God says, "I want to show myself strong." God says, "Here I am and I have all this power. I'm all powerful, omnipotent, all power, omnipresent, and omniscient." God says, "I have this power and I want to show myself strong. I want to really help some people." God, who are you going to help? Who are you looking for to aid? And God says, "I want to show my power on behalf of those who have a perfect heart." In this verse, 2 Chronicles 16, 9, God, the all-powerful being, says he's almost desperate to use his great power for people. God says, "Each day I am searching the earth to show myself strong, to give great help and great assistance to." Now, I'm not suggesting that God is still doing miracles. I am suggesting that God works providentially and that providential power is more than sufficient to do whatever needs done. God is eagerly searching the earth to find people that he can help in every possible way. It's almost that he is itching to use his power to aid people. Now, as you think about the earth, do we not have some people who need help? I know a lot of poor people. I know a lot of people who have medical issues. I can find probably 1,000 people, not looking very hard, who need some kind of assistance. But the help in 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9, as you look at what the text says, that help is not being extended to just anybody. God says, "I'm searching the earth, I'm scouring your planet to find people who fall into a certain category. The perfect heart, 2 Chronicles 16:9, will unleash the power of God. But remember from Psalm 78, verse 41, where we were just a minute ago, what about that imperfect heart? That's going to restrict, that's going to limit the power of God. Now, I don't know about you, but when I look at 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9, I'm thinking, sign me up. God, if that's what you're doing every single day, you are searching the earth for people that you want to use your great power with to aid them and help them every step of the way. How can I get on that list? We've already seen the answer. That is that perfect heart. Somebody says, well, help me understand that a little bit. Remember Matthew 5:48, Jesus also talked about you shall be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, that's not sinless, obviously. A perfect heart, I'm going to sum it up as faith and faithfulness. Those are the two key words if you want that perfect heart. In our local congregation, the place where we attend, especially as I look out over the people who are here this morning, I suspect that you might be one of the most committed members in your local congregation. When something needs done, you're there. When you die, at your funeral, probably people are probably going to come and say, well, who's going to help us now? Who's going to replace this individual? That kind of faithfulness, that kind of dedication is required. That's built into 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9. But we might be the most dedicated Christian in this state. But you know, we can still cut off. We can still restrict or limit God's power. You see, with that great commitment, and that is absolutely essential, but that's only half the equation. With that great commitment, we also need great faith. We can be extremely zealous for God, but can we be a worrywart? We can be so committed to God, but when it comes to our health, we worry, especially after the kids are gone. Maybe in the later years, for whatever reason, younger workers are brought in, we worry about a job. As we're looking at retirement, perhaps, in the not-so-distant future, maybe we're anxious about that. As we look at our life, even though we're almost burning the candle at both ends for God, there's worry after worry. And not only is there worry, maybe there's fear. And we can just go down the list. I fear this, I fear that, and I fear this too. And then with that worry, with that fear, with that anxiety, maybe there's also doubt. Worry, fear, doubt, wrong priorities, those will limit, restrict, choke off God's power in our life, as we see from Psalm 78. If we are a zealous Christian, we've got to have that absolute faith in God. How many times have we heard James 2? Faith and works. Remember that? Lots of sermons. And we sometimes do really well with the works part of it. But when it comes to the faith, sometimes I think that's where we think that we can skate and get off okay. If you want your life to be changed, if you want to see that promise in 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9 unfold and come to life in your life, concentrate on the faith. God is ready, we might say, to bend over backwards to those who are willing to have faith and faithfulness. That point is expressed in a lot of different ways in the Bible. One of those ways is by the word run. If you're not trying to run for God, and you're not trying to run for God with absolute faith and confidence in Him when your kids are home, start when they leave. Run for God. You might say, well, I've got asthma. I've got COPD. I've got bad knees. I've got a bad back. I've got arthritis. Run for God. Not literally, figuratively. Run as far as being active. And run when it comes to faith. Eliminate. Start chopping off that fear, that doubt, that worry, the anxiety, the wrong priorities. When it comes time to assemble, don't just come. Be one of the first who arrives at the building. After you come in, look for things that need to be done. If trash needs to be emptied, if bulletins need to be folded, if songbooks need to be put away, get to work. Hand out bulletins to visitors. Look for people to greet. Look for people to encourage. If someone is struggling to get in, maybe the parking lot is a little wet, walk across the lot and help them. If a teacher is late to a child's class, go into that class. Encourage the young people. Encourage the aged. Care for the widows. Be the kind of person who helps and works in every possible way. And with our works, make sure that we seek to trust God more and more each day. Learn to trust God for the small stuff. That's easy to do. And also learn to trust God for the big stuff. For the men who attend a business meeting, I've been at some of those over the years, and I've lived long enough, preached long enough, to realize that there are some meetings where something comes up, and the first question is, how much money do we have in the account? Now, that's a good question to ask. But you know, if that's the basis, if that's the total basis for whether or not we're going to do something, where's faith? Well, we can't do that because there's not quite enough money in the account. Can't God provide? If he can't, what are we doing there? Doesn't the Bible say walk by faith and not by sight? Wouldn't that apply to the business meeting? When we're talking about how much money's in the checking account. Somebody says, well, we've got this good work. We're a congregation, we've only got 42 people that attend here on Sunday. How can we possibly put on a lecture show? You want to walk by faith or do you want to walk by sight? Do you want that God of 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9 to work in your life? Or do you want to limit the power of God like the Hebrews? Cut it off. Psalm 78 and verse 41. 4 months ago. A little over that now. 4 months ago, a man in Brazil died. And like some other people, this fellow had a dog. Ambulance comes out, picks the guy up, takes the guy away, and the dog chased the ambulance. Chased the ambulance back to the hospital. For 2 months, this dog stayed at the hospital waiting for its owner to walk out the doors. Finally, the people there decided to have some extra compassion on the dog. They took that dog down to a local kennel about 2 miles away. The dog promptly escaped. Came back to the hospital. And it's been there for the 4+ months since the owner's death. Another story, different country, Japan. There's a story there about a dog. It waited 9 years for its owner to return to the station where it got disconnected from its dog, or from its owner, and that dog died waiting. Now, when you look at those stories, you think, wow, that is a great story. Those are amazing animals. But when you hear those stories, the focus shouldn't be on the dogs. The focus should be on us. You see, our faith, our trust in God, needs to be greater than those dogs. God, I believe. God, I'll wait. And God, I trust in you. We may not have ever thought about things in this way, but let me pose this question. Why would God, 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9, why would God search the earth, wanting to use his great power, and pick people to help who have less faith than those two dogs? See the point? God is simply not going to do that. His help is there. His help is great. And again, not miraculous help. Providential help. And that's just as powerful as the miraculous help. God is overall. But for that to happen, we need that faithfulness, that absolute commitment to God, and then to join that with a faith which is unshakable. Somebody says, well, can you put a little more Bible with that? Okay, let's do it this way. Let's think about an event from Peter's life, Matthew chapter 14. It's a well-known text. Peter, we think about him. He was the fellow who had great commitment when it came to Jesus, wasn't he? Willing to die for the Lord, willing to take out the sword and fight. So he has commitment. He gets an A+ in that category. In Matthew chapter 14, you have a story where there's a great storm and things are not going well. All the disciples are scared. And what does Peter say? Lord, if it's you, bid me to walk on the water. Well, Peter has at that point some faith. He's got the works. He's also got the faith. Now, in this case, I recognize it was a supernatural event. Peter begins to leave the boat and he starts doing what? Walking on the water. But what happens to Peter? What happens when fear, doubt, worry, anxiety happened. Down he goes, right? He began to restrict the power of God by a lack of faith, and he began to sink. That's the exact message of Psalm 78 and verse 41. God is still searching for people to help every single day. That's the picture in 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9. He wants to use that power. But God says, I have two criteria. Number one, you've got to be absolutely committed. And number two, you've got to have absolute trust in me. Paul picked up on this point in Ephesians 3. Ephesians 3 and verse 20. And listen to carefully the words that Paul said. God is able to exceedingly, that's point number one. God is able to abundantly, that's point number two. He is able to do above, point three. All, point four. He's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or even think. Don't try to join the donkey and the ox together, Deuteronomy 22. Learn from the faithfulness of two dogs. Learn the life-changing truths in Psalm 78:41 and 2 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 9. When the kids leave home, faith and faithfulness. Concentrate on that. Apply those things and watch the power of God roar, begin to roar in your life.